that okay? Is that still gonna work?
That's an attempt.
Hello? 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 Okay, we'll be moving on to the other.
These are great socks, eh?
Yeah, they look great.
Yeah, they're fun.
I must admit, some of the other side of the blankets are great.
They're warm,
not
those
budget
blankets.
Yeah.
But they're great. It's just soft.
Yeah.
She gave you a sheet about, is that from downstairs?
Yeah, that's from downstairs, cool. Next to the thing, so. Okay, I'd like
good.
To get that, please.
Wonderful. Will this be on your HPC credit and HPC rewards for you today?
Not today.
No. You know all about our program. You can save 10% off. If you wish to ever open up one of our cards in our store, you can save 10% off all day. These are great socks. And you found everything okay today?
Mm-hmm.
Good. You just out for the weekend? Yeah, hopefully you'll get some of our nice weather. See your last name. Is it Corbett?
Yes.
Signature Sarah there for me, please. That's wonderful. Thank you very much. And thank you for coming into our store today. You have yourself a good day.
Why don't you start by saying who you are, starting
mm-hmm.
with I'm and what your position is.
Okay. I'm Susan LaGrove, and I'm the regional manager for Western Canada for Hudson Bay Company Galleries and Heritage Tourism. And I have the pleasure of working here in Victoria in this unique gallery.
So where are we right now?
We're in the Bay Center on the fourth floor in our Hudson Bay Heritage Gallery, which is the first of its kind the company has done. And we have since rolled one out to Montreal, and our goal is to have one this year, 2005, in Toronto, and then gradually each year all the major cities will have the opportunity to have a little history in their store to share with the customers. So,
great. Could you give me a tour? What are we looking at?
Well, I always say my gallery is divided into what I call three themes. So right now we're looking at a typical retail store from the late 1800s. If you were coming into Victoria and were heading off to the gold fields to make your fortune, these were all the kinds of supplies you had to get in order to survive for the year out in the gold fields. We do have an interactive quiz in different languages that you can play with as well and see how good you are at guessing the cost of supplies back in the 1800s. So it just sort of creates that atmosphere for people to see how everybody lived in those days.
So what kind of goods are there?
Well, your basics, we've got, you know, Bovril, which was good for your soups, etc. Oh, good old cod liver oil, everybody needs that. You got your flour, your sugar, your coffee, your tea, some soap, your basic dishes, good old HBC Point blanket to keep you warm, your flannel shirts and your wool socks, exciting things like that. And, of course, your gold pan and your lanterns and snowshoes. Paddles for your canoe, all these essentials of life.
Could you explain the significance of the blanket?
The blanket was first imported by the company in 1780. It is 100% wool. They're very, very warm. The First Nations people really liked them, and the Métis actually adopted them so that they made them into what we call a capote, which is a French word for hooded coat. We do workshops here, too, that show people how to make your own coats from the bay blanket. But the blankets were an essential part of the trade that the company had because now the natives had one big piece of fabric. Rather than having to get all these skins and sew them together to keep warm, they could just wrap this blanket around them, and they were quite valued, and they're quite valued even today. So, yeah, great part of history. And they come in many colors, which a lot of people don't realize. And different regions had preferences over certain colors, or if it was a certain ceremony, they liked a different color as well. So it's rather than our basic cream with our four multi-stripes, it's interesting to look at the other colors as well. Yeah. That's our telephone ringing in the back.
Okay. That's a very interesting sound. Yeah. So is there anything else in this display you want to... what was that?
That's a model of the SS Beaver, which actually the original ran aground just here in Vancouver off Stanley Park on Brockton Point. And it was the first steamship paddle wheeler that came up on the West Coast. So it was a great part of our company's history as well. And the reason they liked the paddle wheeler was because it could go up the rivers as well. So it didn't have a lot of depth. So it was quite, you know, could go through shallow water as well as being great out on the ocean as well. So it was a great part of our history.
Else from this section?
We'll talk about the beaver pelts if you like. Sure, so here we have some beaver pelts, which of course... In this section we have a stack of beaver pelts, which of course were a very important part of our company's history. That's what got them over here to begin with in 1670, and they traded and the Indians, that as they were called in those days, were great for going out and trapping all these, bringing them back. They loved to get the European goods that the company was bringing over, you know, the axe heads, the metal ones, versus having stone ones to try and chop down their trees. And it started to make their life easier because they could get, you know, kettles and different things rather than using the clay pots. So the beaver pelt was a very important part of our history and was for high fashion in Europe for all the top hats, etc., that everybody wanted in those days. So... And here we have a scene that's to make as if you had been out voyaging all day, paddling your canoe, and now you're by your campfire at night, and you're getting ready to have dinner. But also on the wall we have a map of Canada that is out of Peter C. Newman's book, and it sort of depicts where quite a few of the forts and trading posts were. Not all of them are displayed, but again, it's interactive. You can push the... buttons and you see different forts at different times. It shows where the company first started out around Hudson's Bay. It also shows you the Northwest Company, who is our competition, and it shows you their forts. And then when they...
Just a sec. You good? I could hear that.
Oh.
Back.
That
okay.
Squeaky floor.
So it also shows the Northwest Company.
Also shows the Northwest Company, and it shows once we merged in 1821, it shows all the forts. And, of course, on there it shows Fort Vancouver down on the Columbia River in Oregon, which was a very important part of our history. And the company wanted to remain British, so when the Americans were moving out west, we knew the 49th parallel was going to go through. So that's how Victoria got established, actually. James Douglas was sent up and needed to find a new location that would be on the West Coast that could be the company's permanent main focus for being able to look after the West Coast. So that's how we ended up in Victoria. So it just gives you a little bit of history. It also shows you current day stores across Canada. We have over 500 stores in our company, all in Canada, coast to coast. And so you get to sort of get a feel for the difference between the northern post and where we are today, which is all pretty well close to the border, because that's where our population is. Not too many of us want to live further north, right? Too cold. Yeah, so it just shows a bit of history, and it shows you Rupert's Land, which was all the waterways draining into Hudson's Bay, which was granted by King Charles II to Prince Rupert, and that's sort of how we started out. He didn't realize how much land he was granting him at that time, obviously, but when you look at the map, it's interesting to see. And our official title today on any legal documents is still the Governor and Company of Adventurers Trading into Hudson's Bay, which is kind of an interesting title. A little bit different from just the bay. So it shows you a lot of history there. And you can also see from Fort Garry, which is Winnipeg, Manitoba, the Red River runs down into the United States, into Minnesota and the Dakotas and stuff. So another part of our history where we were actually involved in the United States as well.
Could you one more time say our official title is, just because that's great to have.
Our official title is the Governor and Company of Adventurers Trading into Hudson's Bay. So, great.
Yeah, it is. Okay.
So then we go on to, we have three different videos here, which are only a couple of minutes long, that starts out with the beginning, sort of the first 100 years, and it goes into the fur trade to retail, and then in modern day history, sort of shows you the history of the company. So kind of interesting to watch those. And then we actually go into a dining room theme, which is set in the 1920s. And the reason that time was picked was because of the fact that what we know as modern retail today, the former Bay store that we just moved from about 18 months ago, and it's just further down here on Douglas, was actually built in 1921.
Wait a second.
Yeah. Oh, I can shut that off.
Okay, yeah, go ahead.
Okay, so in here we have a dining room theme from the 1920s. And as I mentioned, the former store opened in 1921. So what you have here is the mom and dad are sitting at their dining room table getting ready for a party, and they have their fine china out. The mother's looking through a catalog from 1927. So you do get to look at it on the computer here, and it shows you page by page all the fashions from that era, what the costs were. The father's looking at a magazine called the Beaver Magazine, and this was actually a magazine started in 1920 by the company almost as a newspaper for the employees, so they knew what was happening in different locations across Canada. And on the computer there beside the dad, we actually have issues from 1920s and 30s that you can look through and see what was taking place in history at that time. Now, this magazine is still produced 6 times a year by the Canadian Historical Society, so it's a great magazine for anybody that loves history. They can still get it, so they get to share lots of interesting stories in it. You also have in here a telephone. You can listen to different conversations that are taking place in Victoria back in the 20s. The radio, you can tune in and listen to music and talk shows from the 20s. And the other really neat thing we have in here, also the piano, if you know how to play it, you can sit down and do that. But the artwork in here are originals, and these are what we call the calendar series of paintings. So these were actually paintings that the company commissioned various Canadian artists to paint for them that would show different scenes of history. So it is the artist's interpretation of what took place at that point in history, but the company actually used them on calendars that they used to sell up till 1970. So for our 300th birthday was the last year that they produced the calendars. But you can look on the podium and it shows you each painting, who the artist was, what time in history it's representing, and then which calendar it was on as well. So we do official art tours in here where we spend about an hour talking about each artist and the actual medium that they painted in and different things. And there's no charge for people to come to these events. So it's kind of nice. Like, we have one here that shows the SS Beaver that we were talking about. So that's the SS Beaver in the inner harbor of Victoria and the fort there. And this where the rocks and trees are, that's just across the harbor at the Songhees area. So where we have a hotel sits there now, but was kind of more a little bit more rugged in those days. So it's kind of an interesting venue to look at. This is representing Fort Garry, Winnipeg, and it's supposed to be the Red River carts as they were leaving with all the supplies, etc. And shows you our flag flying high and everybody getting ready to go out and trade. So.
Is there anything else you want to say about the museum?
Well, the other really unique thing that we have here is two original pieces of artwork from the 1600s. One of King Charles II from 1666, and the other a Prince Rupert from 1650. Now, King Charles was painted by Sir Peter Lilly. The one of Prince Rupert was out of Anthony Van Dyck Studios. We do say contemporary copy on his. It is an original from his studio, but we can't guarantee he was the sole artist because a lot of his students assisted him on his artwork. So, but these have always been in the corporate boardroom, so this is the first time they've been on public display. So it's kind of a nice feature for people to come and see. We do lots of programs here for schools, and we always have all kinds of activities happening where people can come and you know, hear guest speakers, you know, make coats. We have a teddy bear tea today where you can make coats for your bears. So we're always having fun here. So we like to share it with people.
So, great. Well, thank you. Okay.
Well, you're welcome.
Without proper hearing protection or the Air Force thing. Oh. So they take out the bones and put metal in there. Yeah, that's interesting.
Okay, so can you start off with your name?
Yeah.
And what you do for Hudson's Bay Company, or
well,
what
okay.
do you know about? And can you start with I am? So like it's
sure,
a sentence that
sure, absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I'm Dr. Tim Ball, and
can
I'm
you
not-
start again, sorry, because I was finishing talking.
I am Dr. Tim Ball, and I'm not employed by the Hudson Bay Company, but I spent my academic career working on the Hudson Bay Company records. I'm a climatologist by training, studying weather. And the archives in Winnipeg, the company records, have one of the best climate records anywhere in the world, because from the minute they arrived in North America, they started recording the weather on a daily basis. And they then brought thermometers and barometers to Churchill, Manitoba in 1768, and then they spread them throughout a lot of their posts. So it provides us with one of the longest and earliest records of climate data. And the other thing they did was that they started recording the landscape. That is that they measured the land, mapped it, recorded plant life and everything else. And it's a huge opportunity, because one of the problems we've got in the world today is, what are the impacts of Europeans on a landscape? And here in the company archives, or at least in Winnipeg in the company archives, you've got a very detailed description of almost half the continent. And from that, we can measure what changes have occurred. So it's a remarkable thing. And so that's what my career was around. And so, of course, it also, you can't read those archives without becoming interested in the people and the history. And I set up something called the Rupert's Land Research Center, which was designed to promote the archives and assist researchers going to Winnipeg. And I published a lot about the company. The most recent publication in October of 2003 was a book on the naturalists of the 18th century. Because the first book done on Arctic zoology was published by Thomas Pennant.
Can you say it was published again?
Yeah, and sorry?
Can you say it was published again? Can you start from there?
Yeah, it was published in the 1790s by Thomas Pennant, and it called Arctic zoology, and all of the information came from the fur traders the employees of the company were sending materials back to the Royal Society. And I think that's what makes the company unique, is that it was very aware of its environment, and it of course had to live off the land as well. And so it's an incredible record.
So can you give me a basic history of the company?
Well, the company started out...
Can you start off with the Hudson's Bay Company?
Sure. Okay, the Hudson Bay Company started out in an era when exploration and development in a mercantile sense, that is in a merchant sense, was beginning. And there was the Dutch East India Company as an example. And the Hudson Bay Company was called the Company of Adventurers. And it was people that were looking for resources and looking to expand overseas, because the wealthy in Europe started to realize that they could build their wealth beyond their shores. And so, of course, the concept of the fur trade and the concept of the resources of North America made it very attractive. One of the things that I try to point out to people is that the demand for furs increased because the climate was so cold in the 17th and 18th century. You know, you're talking about 3 feet of ice on the Thames in 1683. But then it evolved very naturally, and the company were just incredibly inventive in terms of what they found as business opportunities. Everything from moose hooves to shipping ice from the Yukon to the California Gold Rush, and even trying to ship ice to Hawaii, by the way. And so they just, it was a remarkable. I've always said that it's the largest and most successful multinational corporation, long before the concept of multinationals ever evolved. And the company was very democratic. They didn't care who you were or where you came from. If you could work for them and produce for them, you were hired. And that included all sorts of nationalities. So you got Norway House in Manitoba, where there were a lot of Norwegians. And of course, in Fort Vancouver, the Hawaiians that were brought over to support that fur trade there. And at the height of their power, the company...
Did you say that again?
Okay.
Sorry to pee.
Okay. At the height of their power, the company controlled 1/12 of the world's land surface. That's after the amalgamation in 1821 with the Northwest Company. And there's only two people in history that have controlled more territory, and that one was George III, and of course we know what happened to some of his territory. And the other was Catherine the Great of Russia. And they literally circled the world. And Sir George Simpson, who was the governor at the amalgamation, traveled around the world 3 times, including going to Hawaii, just visiting his empire. He crossed the Atlantic 32 times in the days of sail, which gives you an idea of the scope of his empire. And the company paid a minimum of 10% dividends every year for 150 years, and I don't think there's a company in the world that'll ever equal that, because they come and go so rapidly. And from a Canadian perspective, certainly all of Central and Western Canada, it's based around corporations, the Hudson Bay Company, and then later the Canadian Pacific Railway Company. And there's no other nation in the world that has that kind of background. But the company itself was also almost like a nation. It had its own money, and it had essentially nation-state control over its territories.
So do you know how it got involved in the fur trading business and got involved with Hawaii?
Yeah, well, in the Hawaiian business, well, the fur trade started, of course, because the demand for furs increased. There was a reduction of flow of furs from Russia because of wars and so on, and then the colder temperatures. And then, as I say, the search for resources. Furs weren't the only thing they were looking for, but that was the thing that immediately attracted attention. And it wasn't just the ordinary furs, like the beaver, but it was also the luxury furs, what we'd call luxury furs today, ermine and so on. Because if you look at any... If you look at any aristocrat or person of rank in Europe, they always had furs. It was a symbol, a famous painting of Elizabeth I with the ermine, live ermine on her arm as a symbol of wealth. But then it evolved, I say, very rapidly. One of the things that happened was that kind of the quirks of history was that the Huguenots, were chased out of France, and the Huguenots were superb felt makers. And the short fur, the made beaver fur, when you look at it under a microscope, is barbed, and when you pound it, it makes a very, very thin and very... I'm Dr. Tim Ball, and I'm a climatologist. Climatologist by training. I'm Dr. Tim Ball. I'm a climatologist by training, and I did my doctoral thesis using the archives of the Hudson Bay Company to reconstruct the weather of the last 300 years. The Huguenots were chased out of France, and they were superb felt makers. That was their guild and their talent. And the beaver fur that was coming from North America, the short or made beaver, as it's called, the fur, it's got barbs, and it when pounded, it makes very, very thin, very strong felt. That, of course, became used for making the beaver hats, and they became fashionable, and it was a huge push to the whole fur trade industry. Went out of fashion, by the way, when Prince Albert, Queen Victoria's husband, decided he didn't like wearing hats, and so like with anything fashionable, but by that time, the company had diversified, and that was its great talent, was its ability to see business opportunities and diversify. And I guess a measure of that is the development of the Pacific trade. One of the things that, when you read the archives, the single thing that surprises you, and certainly me most, was the extent to which these people traveled and the impunity with which they traveled. You know, I mean, we think about a great challenge of going to the airport and getting on an airplane, but you imagine stepping out of the post, say, in Toronto, and then say, I'm gonna walk to the West Coast. And it's very difficult to get your mind around that, yet they did those things with impunity, as I said. So, for example, when they opened up on Hudson Bay at Churchill, within 2 years, the Aboriginal people were coming around the coast of the Arctic to Churchill to trade, and going back to the Mackenzie Delta in one summer. And another example is John Ray was at Churchill on Hudson Bay, wanted to learn surveying, so on go the snowshoes, and he snowshoes to Winnipeg, which is about 700 miles, gets there to find out that the fellow that could teach him has died. So then somebody said, well, there's somebody in Montreal can teach you, so he snowshoes to Montreal. So I say, we have no idea. We can't get our minds around that travel. But part of that, of course, was out on the oceans, crossing the Atlantic and crossing the Pacific. And so, of course, the Sandwich Islands, as they were then known, named by Captain Cook after his sponsor, the Earl of Sandwich, were a very important place for movement of shipping. It was a natural stopping place for water supply and fresh vegetables and so on. And of course, trade began with some of the tropical produce from Hawaii that was coming to the West Coast here. And then in return, there was timber and furs, and coal was an interesting one that developed on the West Coast here. And of course, that became more important when steam power came in. And part of the battle for the Pacific was the battle between the American Fur Trade Company, particularly...
Can you start with part again?
Yeah. Part of the development of the fur trade was the on the West Coast here, was the battle with the Jacob Astor's Fur Trade Company, the Astoria Fur Company. And the Hudson Bay Company developed a policy of essentially trapping out all the furs in an area to make it unattractive to the competition, and it worked very well. But also part of that competition, of course, was the growing merchant trade across the Pacific Ocean from Asia and Alaska and in Hawaii, of course. And so it didn't take long before trade was going in both directions. And the company had an agent in Hawaii in 1840. He was actually a British government employee, but he was also agent for the company. And Simpson visited there later, in 1860, just reestablished the trade and saw the potential for the trade. Some other things that went, of course, salmon was a natural product. Dried salmon was a natural product. So there was trade going back and forth. Now, the company also had a practice of trying to hire local people. As I said, they were very democratic, and they tried to hire people that were suitable for the climate and the trade that they were in. So, for example, when they left England, they went through the Orkney Islands off the coast of Scotland. It was a very bleak, windblown area. And to give you an idea, in 1800, of the 700 employees in North America, about 500 or more of them were Orkney Islanders because they could stand the rigors of the Arctic and the wind. Well, the same was true of the Hawaiians with the West Coast. And so they brought them over, and some of them never went back. And one community in Washington State is named after an Hawaiian gentleman by the name of Kalama. And at one point, Fort Vancouver, half of the company employees there were from the Hawaiian Islands. So it became part of then really a Pacific trade triangle, just as there had been a trade triangle in the Atlantic between the Caribbean and the East Coast and Britain. And so that was the Hawaiian connection.
And so what specifically was the triangle, just so you say?
Well, the triangle was basically from the West Coast here, from Fort Vancouver and then Victoria to Honolulu, and then Alaska was part of that because the company also had stores in Alaska. They also had stores in Russia, of course, and the Bering Straits. And so that was really the triangle that existed in the Pacific. At the other end, of course, it hooked up with the spice trade and then that was going into Asia, and silk. And that continued, of course, still continues today, and in fact has grown back again today. A good example of the in Canada was the silk used to come in from Asia through Hawaii. And when it arrived in Vancouver, there was a special train set aside by the Canadian Pacific Railway called the Silk Train. And it had priority on the track right through to Toronto, and all the people waiting there to buy the first load of silk coming in from the Orient. So, you know, they had their fads in those days, just like we do today.
So why do you think, was there any possibility of Britain becoming protectorate of Hawaii as opposed to the United States?
Yes, that was part of the battle. The companies tried to stay out of that. The company...
Could you say, like a complete sentence, so that I... Britain and America were arguing over Hawaii or something?
Well, Britain and America were arguing over territory everywhere. I mean, the Lewis and Clark expedition was triggered by the journals of Alexander Mackenzie, the Hudson Bay Company employee, who had traveled out to the West Coast from Fort Chipewyan and came to Bella Coola here in British Columbia. As soon as his diaries were published in England after he retired, a copy was on Thomas Jefferson's desk within 2 months. Jefferson saw that as a huge threat to his idea of continentalism, that America would occupy the whole continent. And so he then went and got Lewis and Clark and sent them out both as exploration but also as a sovereignty claim to the Northwest here. And but that... those sovereignty claims extended beyond the coast, of course, to Hawaii. And the British eventually won out with Hawaii. But then it turned back to the Americans in the end anyway. It didn't, of course, that didn't happen. We got the division between Canada and the United States here in the Northwest. But the whole thing was about competition both for land with the governments and competition for trade with the companies like the Jacob Astor Company and the Hudson Bay Company.
Could you describe how they set up forts and why they set up forts? Describe a fort.
Sure. Well, a fort was, the basic idea was they were called factories because it was a place of factoring, that is making things and doing business. And the person that ran it was the factor, the chief factor. And of course, were defensive in the early days because of concern about attack. And so they built a palisade. Usually it was done with the vertical timber set into the ground. And then within that, you built the buildings that you lived in that were divided between the stores where business was done and the living quarters, which, interestingly enough, were called apartments, which in England, of course, is a word that came over to the States and continued, went out of use in England, they call them flats. And so there was a pretty standard pattern, and the designs were done, recommended by the company in England. The most extreme example of that was the fort, the stone fort built up at Churchill. And they sent masons over from England to help build the stone fort. But the standard pattern, as I said, was the palisades surrounding the place of doing business and the place of living. And within that, of course, the store was off limits, usually, to the Aboriginal people, other than those that were considered to be the leaders to do the trade. And they would go in and do the trade, and then the other people would sit outside. At a lot of the forts, there were encampments that set up outside the fort. That always happens, as you know, even with military posts today. They were referred to as plantations, which is an unfortunate term, the connotations of that. But the idea was that these were people that were living close to the fort and working and helping with the company. And a lot of times their employment was in things like getting food supply. So, for example, at many of the posts, the spring goose hunt, which was critical, that was done mostly by the Aboriginal people because they were far more efficient hunters. And also the collecting of gathering of larger game, venison and moose and so on. And so there was a symbiotic relationship. There were some intermarriages in what was called the façon de pay, but a fashion of the country. But generally, the Hudson Bay Company discouraged that. They didn't think that it was a good idea. The Aboriginal people liked it, of course, because it gave them, they thought it would give them trade preference. So there were all sorts of social maneuverings going on, if I can put it in that term. But generally, it was a very good symbiotic relationship, and some very, very strong friendships developed. I mean, I think about the story of Augustine in northern Quebec, who was he was called that because he came into the post in August, and he became very good friends with George Back, who was a major Arctic explorer for the company. And he heard Augustine heard that Back was missing, so he walked right around Hudson Bay. If you look at the map and see that distance, got there to find out that Back had been found. And so he shook his hand and glad to see him, and then walked home again. And so, as I said, it was very much a business-like relationship. Yeah, how's your hand doing there?
Get all right. Yeah. So what did Hawaiians do for?
Well, the Hawaiians were mostly processing the furs. You see, in that attempt to harvest out the furs in the Northwest, in the Oregon territory. The company, well, they were bundling up furs as fast as they could do it, and so that was the main employment of the Hawaiians that came over, was to dress the furs, and to dressing them, of course, meant preparing the made beaver, and then bundling them up for shipment back to England. It was the main occupation. The other things that the employees did, obviously, you couldn't make furs all year round, but it was a major part of it. But they things like cutting firewood. And one of the things that we forget today with energy, we just push the thermostat, and the number of people that are providing that heat is minimal. But at a lot of the posts, the company, I would say 90.
Again,
at a lot of the posts, I would say that certainly in the more northerly regions, you had 90% of the men spending 90% of their time cutting firewood, just to stay warm. Now, there was also cutting of timber, of course, for construction purposes. And then there was also carrying out the trade, transporting the trade goods to the outposts, and all the other activities. Hauling water was another major activity, because fresh water is always a problem anywhere you are. And so those were the activities that were. Now, the other thing the company did was in the long winter months, especially, they provided education to both their own employees and to the Aboriginal people, teaching them to read and write. And a lot of the company employees that came, Hawaiians and Orkney Island men, for example, were illiterate. And I think of William Thomason, who was an illiterate Orkney man. He learned to read and write, and he ended up being the governor of the Northern Territory. So it was another example of the democracy of the company. So the long winter evenings were quite often taken up with that. And of course they had strict routines of religious ceremonies they had to follow and so on. So each post was almost run like a paramilitary type of operation. But that's essential, I think, if you're going to have any control over what's going on.
So what other nationalities or ethnic groups were employed, and how did they all get along?
Well, I've never come across any conflicts. So the greater conflicts were between the companies, the Northwest Company employees and the Hudson Bay companies, and that got quite nasty at times. But I've never seen any conflict. The range of nationalities, I think there's at least 14 that I know of, and including the Hawaiians, Icelanders, Norwegians, Scots, Orkney people, French, just a very wide range of people involved. And of course, a lot of them looking for adventure and signing up with the company. It was almost like the Foreign Legion, you know, attraction. But the other thing that you have to remember is that to sign on with the company, you've got a 5-year contract minimum and everything found. So you got your clothing and your food, plus your pay. And so some of the men never spent a nickel. I mean, Anthony Handy worked for the company for 26 years and he went back to England with every penny he'd ever been paid. And so that was a very attractive contract in those days. And one of the things that was attractive was the guarantee of one meal a day. There's something, again, that we can't think about. But to somebody in the 18th century to say, we're going to give you one meal a day, that's tremendous guarantee. And Hearn writes about that in that even amongst the Aboriginal people, he's with them for 2.5 years, and he'll have entries in his journal like, say, we haven't eaten for 7 days. It's not a complaint. It's a statement of fact. And I say, well, that's the second thing beyond the travel, is the hunger and the constant search for food. And certainly that would have been the attraction for a lot of the Hawaiian Island young men that came over. And of course then the security of it, that they say that quite a lot of them didn't go back to Hawaii.
So do you know how much they were paid?
It varied through time, and I can't tell you about what the Hawaiian Islanders were paid. In the early days it was the contracts varied depending on what you were doing, but for a laborer it was £5 a year. That went up over time. As I said, it really was pocket money in the sense that everything was provided for you. So the pay is, it's very difficult to make comments about the pay that they received. One of the things that the company did do, and they've always been accused of being paternalistic, but if a man was married, the man did not receive all of his pay in North America, that the company would keep money in an account for the family to make sure the families weren't left destitute. And I think it's the side of the company that I think is very commendable. And the fact that the governor's notes are full of granting £20, £50 to widows of the company. I mean, they looked after their employees very well. And of course, those things were known. Judith Hudson Beatty, who was keeper of the archives in Winnipeg, published a book called Undelivered Letters. And I don't know if there's certainly, not to my knowledge, anything about Hawaiians in there, but these were men that were working on the Northwest coast here, and letters coming out from England, and they weren't delivered because the man had died or he'd moved to, or left the company or something. And of course, the company kept every scrap of paper that was ever written on. So the letters went back to England and were filed in a file called Undelivered Letters. And they're a marvelous social history of how dependent the family were on the money that these men were making and were sending home. You know, how critical that was to the family. And I say an insight into the social history of Britain that you just don't get written anywhere else. I mean, the letters are not very well written, a lot of them, but I mean, they're heartfelt in the stories they tell. I say I don't know about any correspondence of Hawaiians in the record.
So you were talking earlier about how only recently Hudson's Bay Company has gotten interested in its heritage again, or acceptable?
Well, it had kept incredible records because if you're making decisions in London, you need a lot of information. So they kept superb records, books. There were the mess books, accounts books, trading journals, ship's logs. Everything was recorded, and they were carried back to England. And so that practice of keeping information and the records that were there, and during the war they moved them out of London so they wouldn't be destroyed in the Blitz. But with the development of two things in its history. One was a trial brought by an Englishman by the name of Dobbs, who was an Anglo-Irish aristocrat, who accused the company of hiding how much wealth it had and what potential there was in North America. And he brought a lawsuit on behalf of the ordinary people of England, saying that these merchants are not telling you everything, and you're subsidizing it in a way, and you should have a share of it. So the Dobbs trial began, and Dobbs made a very good case. It was amazing how much information he had for that time. But he lost the case because most of his information came from disaffected employees. That is, employees who had an axe to grind, and of course any lawyer would pick up on that. But it made the company very defensive about what it was doing. So for example, when two astronomers came over in 1769, they weren't allowed to live in the company quarters. They were set off in their own quarters, and they were restricted to where they could go and what they could do. Now that gradually eased, of course. You just can't keep a hold on all of it. And then in the 1970s, with the anti-fur trade protest, the company had been gradually getting out of the fur trade business. And ironically, the last furs that it sold came from the XY Company, which was a company that it had been in competition with in the East in the early days. And but eventually they said, no, we're not going to trade furs anymore. But the concern about, you know, that history part lingered for some time. And I would say up until about 5 years ago, when they suddenly realized that they didn't have that concern anymore, and that the history was an integral part of the society, and it was also, of course, a great marketing tool. And what company would have that? Well, we've been in business for 300 some years, you know, we've got credibility. And this gallery that we're in is a part of that. This is the first manifestation of this awareness and spreading of its history. And of course, what it does is that people come in who have their own memorabilia and stories, and, you know, descendants of former Hudson Bay Company employees. And so it's really an exciting rebirth, if you want, of what's going on. And by the way, just to give you an idea of the scale of the archives in Winnipeg, there's 250,000 photographs in the archives alone, going back to the 19th century. Many of them taken, or virtually all of them taken, by company employees that turned them over to the company, and when they were put into the archives. I can't think of a single photographic archive like that that covers half a continent for that long a time. Yet it's hardly been cataloged, you know. But so it's an absolute gold mine. Yeah.
Can you explain what the company is today?
Well, the company today, it was divided up into the northern stores, which is the stores throughout northern Canada, and then of course the retailing chains across the south, and the stores, this one here in Victoria, a good example of that. And there's a lot of sentiment towards the Hudson Bay Company. You know, there was a recent talk about the company being bought out by an American company, and Canadians don't get up on their high horse very often, but there's a lot of comments about that, and it's done very well in fitting into a certain level of merchandising, sort of between the Walmart and the very exclusive stores, and it has a very good reputation for return policies, for example, and things like that. So it. That's really where it fits into the marketplace today, and it covers Canada. Now, in the Arctic and the northern stores is a slightly different situation, because in many of those communities, it's the only retail source. And so the company in the early days stuck strictly to very utilitarian things, probably an outgrowth of Simpson and the Scottish Presbyterian mentality, but they didn't sell jewelry or silk or trinkets or anything like that. That, by the way, left a niche market for what were called the peddlers. So you get, coming into Canada and the northern United States, itinerant tradespeople or merchants, quite a lot of them Jewish. And there was in Winnipeg, in the middle of the 19th century, there was a place called Finkelstein's Emporium, where you could get, and you could just imagine that store. And it, as I said, it filled a niche that the company didn't provide. And that was one of the criticisms in the North, that they were really just very utilitarian. But then surviving in the North is, you need utilitarian things. The other thing, by the way, that I think people need to understand about the company throughout most of its history is that it always extended credit. That the fur trade functioned by the trappers, almost all Aboriginal, coming in and being provided with goods, blankets, shotguns, and so on. And then they would come in the spring and pay off their debt. And they paid it off in terms of the furs that they brought in. And so, as I said, it was a very progressive kind of program with that. And of course, bookkeeping was quite a problem. And of course, there was also the problem, the company quite often had to absorb losses if there were no furs. And the cycle of furs and the pattern of wildlife, of course, some things I've studied, and you get years at the end of the 18th century, for example, you know, God send us better times, no game, no furs, no trade, and Indians are starving, really, really harsh times with the climate changes that were going on.
So are there any other stories about Hawaiians, any other, I mean,
well, the Hawaiians. Well, I think the only other one that always intrigues Susan and I is the one about the ice, you know, where the... they were shipping ice from, say, from the Yukon to California in the Gold Rush, and they were selling it at $1,000 a ton. And they tried to ship the ice to Hawaii and packed it in straw and tried to protect it, but unfortunately, it didn't make the trip. It melted en route. But again, it's a measure of the enterprise of the company that they would try anything to promote a business. But it was a very, very thin connection in a way with Hawaii, but it's one that hasn't been developed and most people don't know about, and particularly the fact that people were moving in both directions, the fact that Hawaiians, Native Hawaiians, had come to the West Coast here, and then the extent of the trade and the nature of the trade. I mean, who'd ever dream of coal from Nanaimo, Canada, going to Hawaii? So those are the things I think that are most outstanding about it. And then the fact that over those distances, doing that kind of trade.
Can you? I get you to say just a sentence when it was founded.
Well, the company, the charter was issued in 1670 by King Charles II to Prince Rupert
You start again. Yeah, Hudson's Bay sorry. Company was
the Hudson Bay Company charter was granted in 1670 by King Charles. And it was granted to Prince Rupert as a favor for Prince Rupert's helping him in his wars in Europe. And, of course, that's why it was called Rupert's Land. And that was the basis of the company called the Company of Adventurers. Most of the investors in that early company were, in fact, all of them were they were wealthy aristocrats. And that later gave the company, of course, a great advantage when they amalgamated with the Northwest Company in 1821. And just to give you an idea of the extent of the territories and the involvements, the charter of amalgamation runs to 12,000 pages. That's in 1821. So the lawyers were busy even then making money. So, yeah, 1670 is when it began. And what's interesting is this Victoria store, which they took over. They had their opening day on May the 2nd, to celebrate the day on which the charter was issued in 1670. And there's been other events associated with that date, because in Manitoba, for example, they brought the archives from Winnipeg in 1970 to celebrate the 100th anniversary of the province of Manitoba and the 300th anniversary of the Hudson Bay Company. So the intertwining of that date and those with the people of Canada, you see it everywhere.
Nice. Is there anything else that you think I could use, that you'd like to say?
Oh, there's so much. I don't even know where to start. Susan will laugh. I wish that more people knew about the history of the company and the value of it in terms of beyond just being a business, of its contribution. As I said, the science material that it's provided for me and more science researchers. One example, the scientists that I mentioned earlier that came to Churchill in 1768 were sent by the Royal Society to measure something called the transit of Venus. This was the first attempt to measure the distance of the sun from the earth, or the earth from the sun, and so that they could test Newton's theory of gravity. So here it was done out in the wilderness of Hudson Bay, and those men had to spend 13 months for a 7-hour scientific observation. And so the stories like that. But the more important thing to me are the stories of the ordinary people, like the Hawaiians, because I think the company, and I always sum it up by saying it's ordinary people doing extraordinary things. And the sum total of that, of course, is a very successful company and a very successful land that we live in.
Well, thank you very much.